This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Donvan in Washington. Snow steps down, Obama rallies the base, and nothing holds Romney back. It is Wednesday, and time for a
deceptive and a dirty trick
edition of the Political Junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Lipstick.
Oops.
But I'm the decider.
Every week, political junkie Ken Rudin joins us to recap the week in politics. It's been a great week. Mitt Romney takes Tuesday's primaries in Arizona and Michigan. Two Republicans are calling it a day. Three-term moderate Olympia Snow is retiring, she says, due to excessive partisanship. David Dreyer is also announcing his retirement, while former Nebraska Senator Bob Kerrey wants to get back into the game. The president fires up the UAW in Michigan, and simmering culture wars, contraception and abortion bills in the Congress and the states. In a few minutes, we're going to talk with Alan Schroeder about this year's long string of primary debates. There were a lot of them. And what did they accomplish? Later on in the program, Sandra Singh Lowe on why she is ready for her father to die. But first, we begin, as we always do, with a trivia question from you, Ken.
Hi, John. Okay, well, the shocking news of the day yesterday was the announcement that Olympia Snow of Maine announced she would not seek another term. She joins another woman, Kay Bailey Hutchison of Texas, who's retiring after this year. The trivia question is, who was the last female senator to retire after her term was completed?
A question prompted by Senator Snow's decision.
That's correct.
So speaking of Senator Snow's decision, what does this do to the GOP's hopes in the Senate?
Well, of course, you know, Jeff Flake is running from Arizona, so we're going to get rid of Snow, but we'll get Flake. I was just working on that a little bit.
It was
no,
good.
It's bad news. It's terrible news for the Republican Party. This has gone. This decision has taken this seat in Maine. It's given from a safe Republican seat to a likely Democratic takeover. It's a very moderate, mainstream, moderate, liberal state. They do have a Tea Party governor, and we can talk about that at some point, too. But only Olympia Snow probably was going to only be the Republican who could win it. And now you have a lot of Democrats. The filing deadline isn't until March 15th, so they have 2 weeks to file enough signatures to get on the ballot.
Could there not be another moderate Republican in Maine?
Well, there is a state Senate president who was a former Olympia Snow chief of staff who may be the Republican candidate, but there are still also very two popular members of Congress who are running or talking about running. Shelley Pingree from the urban part of the state, if there's such a thing as the urban part of the state of Maine, and Mike Mishu, who's from the rural part, the two members of Congress from the House, from the state. Mishu took out some filing papers even today, so at least he may run and she may run too. It looks like it's a Democratic pickup.
Can you repeat for me the trivia question?
Trivia question was the fact that Olympia Snow announced that she's not going to run, and we already know that Kay Bailey Hutchison is not running. When was the last time a female senator decided to retire when her term was completed?
Let's go to callers and our first correct answer, I hope. Phil from Mitchell, South Dakota. Phil, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Margaret Chase Smith of Maine.
Well, Margaret Chase Smith of Maine was a longtime senator. She was, except she didn't retire on her own. She was defeated for re-election in 1972.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, Phil. We have another Phil in Hollywood, Florida. Phil?
Oh, yes. Hi. How are you? Good afternoon.
Hi.
My guest would be Elizabeth Dole from North Carolina.
Well, again, Elizabeth Dole, like Margaret Chase Smith, tried to win another term, but was defeated. She was defeated in 2006 by Kay Hagan, or 2008. But she was defeated. She didn't retire on her own.
Very well.
I'm amazed by hearing your corrections of the wrong answers.
Oh, I don't forget anything, Steve. John.
Speaking of Steve, David Dreyer is also announcing his retirement as a California Republican Congressman.
He is. That's not a surprise, although it's big news, though. He is the chairman of the House Rules Committee. He's been in Congress since 1981. He came in on the Reagan sweep in 1980. But this independent commission that basically rejiggered the entire California congressional delegation, it left David Dreyer with no place to run. The Republican areas were too far away from his former district. The thing closest to his is a district that Obama carried by with a 61%. So he really had no place to go.
And, so he'd stay in the game if he could.
Oh, yeah. He's chairman of the Rules Committee. He's very, very powerful. I mean, he hasn't lost a step, but he just has no place to run. And this new redistricting in California has really decimated the California delegation. I think this is now the seventh member of Congress from California who's gonna retire because of this. Jerry Lewis, longtime appropriations guy, announced his retirement, and other members will lose too because there are members versus members in the June primary.
Our trivia question is: who was the last female senator to retire after her term was completed? If you think you know the answer, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and the winner gets that fabulous no prize T-shirt.
Incredible it is.
So let's see. Here we have Jim in Hampton Hills, Illinois. Jim, you're on Talk of the Nation. Jim, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hello?
Hello.
Jim, we're waiting for your answer.
What's your guess? What's your correct answer?
Nancy Landon Kassebaum.
Nancy Landon Kassebaum is the correct answer. She's a Republican from Kansas who announced her retirement in 1996, did not run for re-election. She is the last female member of the Senate to retire on her own.
So congratulations, Jim. You get the T-shirt. I want you to stay on the line, and your information will be gathered, and wear it in pride.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much. I want to talk a little bit about Tuesday and what happened in Michigan. I don't know if you would say the expected happened, but we're going to take a listen to it in one moment. I wanted to listen to Mitt Romney's celebration, so why don't you talk about it, and then we're going to hear it.
Well, it shouldn't be a surprise because, as everybody says, and they point out over and over again, that Mitt Romney, this is his home state, where he was born, where he was raised, where his father served as governor throughout most of the 1960s. But a week ago, after his victories in Colorado, Minnesota, and Missouri, Rick Santorum opened up a lead in Michigan as well. And so a lot of people were saying, here we go again. Mitt Romney is the ostensible frontrunner, the guy who's going to take us out of the wilderness to defeat Barack Obama in November. But he was losing, but he won yesterday.
And in this room are the people who knocked on the doors and made the calls and went to the polls, and it made an enormous difference. We didn't win by a lot, but we won by enough, and that's all that counts.
So was it a win? A win, a win?
A win is a win is a win, although if the name of the game is 1,144 delegates, Mitt Romney may not have gotten the most delegates out of Michigan. Right now, that they allocate delegates in Michigan by congressional district. Right now, of the delegates that have been counted, Rick Santorum has 13 delegates. Mitt Romney has 13 delegates. But in the two congressional districts that haven't submitted their totals yet, Rick Santorum is leading in both of them. So Rick Santorum could come out of Michigan with the lead in delegates. But again, the headline is that Romney wins both, and he did win both.
And what's with Santorum urging Democrats to vote in Michigan?
Well, both parties have done it before. I remember, I think it was Karl Rove who talked about, and this didn't begin with Karl Rove, but in 2000, he was saying that maybe Republicans could cause some mischief by voting in the Democratic primary and either trying to sabotage Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or whatever. So that's not a new tactic. It's not a tactic that I particularly care for, but it is something that, you know, Rick Santorum felt that the way to get, you know, obviously if the Democrats would love to see, look, the one thing that Rick Santorum and Barack Obama have in common is that they would both love to have Rick Santorum as a Republican nominee. So if Democrats crossed over, that would help Rick Santorum.
So more on Rick Santorum. This video surfaced from him speaking in October about the speech that John F. Kennedy gave in 1960 when he was running as a Catholic president, and there were concerns about his Catholic faith. And the president gave a speech in which he more or less told a group of evangelicals that he was committed to separation of church and state. Santorum recently, in October, read the speech and said this about it.
I had the opportunity to read the speech, and I almost threw up.
And then on This Week with George Stephanopoulos, over the weekend, George pressed him on this point.
What kind of country do we live in that says only people of non-faith can come in the public square and make their case? That makes me throw up.
You know, I'm sorry, this is a lunchtime program with all of this talk of nausea, but
a lot of people usually feel that after Talk of the Nation. I'm a political junkie. But you know something, that's not what President Kennedy, well, then candidate John F. Kennedy was talking about. He was talking about that they should not be you know, no preference of any religion. He was the first Catholic elected in 1960. Al Smith had run as a Catholic in 1928. But being a Catholic is almost like what being a Mormon is in 2012. They were looked on suspiciously. And Kennedy basically gave that speech not to say that people of faith should not be involved in the public discourse, but that, you know, there should be no preference of religion. And, you know, religion should not be the defining part of a candidate. So I my feeling is that Santorum misread or misrepresented what Kennedy was saying.
Something else he said this week, he commented on President Obama's remarks about it would be a great thing if everybody in America could go to college. And Senator Santorum said this:
not all folks are gifted in the same way. Some people have incredible gifts with their hands. Some people have incredible gifts and use and want to work out there making things. President Obama once said he wants everybody in America to go to college. What a snob.
It got a lot of applause in that room. Did it play well everywhere else, would you say?
Well, look, Rick Santorum is a culture warrior. He this is the way he thinks is the way to the Republican nomination. But to turn his nose down on higher education. I mean, President Obama was not saying that, you know, everybody has to go to college. He just thinks it would be a nice thing if people went to college or higher education. And for Rick Santorum, who, you know, went to all these colleges and got his master, or, you know, he went to graduate school and all that, to say Obama's basically he was saying that higher education and colleges indoctrinate you with liberal philosophy. And that's, you know, look, there are a lot of people who come out of colleges and they wind up conservative. And
going to business school.
Yes. And I even wind up on this program. But anyway, it's the kind of thing that just seems to be over the top language from Rick Santorum.
The road ahead, Super Tuesday, is less than a week away. What do you see?
You have 10 states, primaries and caucuses. Now, again, we saw Romney going down after he lost South Carolina. He moved up again when he won Florida. Then he went down again when he lost Colorado and Minnesota. And now he's up again. But again, it's going to be a tough row. Even though he won to the two states yesterday, Mitt Romney still has tough, you know, a schedule ahead of him. On March 6th, he has Ohio, where Newt Gingrich is campaigning very hard, where Rick Santorum had a lead in the polls until recently. It's going to be tough, and every defeat will be magnified.
Well, we are talking with political junkie Ken Rudin, and up next, after more debates than ever in this political season, was anything actually debated? I'm John Donvan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm John Donvan. It is Wednesday, and that is Political Junkie Day here, and Ken Rudin is with us, as always. Ken, do we have a winner from last week's Scuttlebutton Prize?
We actually do, and that person is, let me find that name, it's Jeff Esposito of Billerica, Massachusetts, and he came up with, I had a button from the Crimea War and a button from a De La Riva, who ran for governor of California, so it became Crimea River. Yes.
I love that.
Yeah, thank you very much. You can get a T-shirt.
I wish you liked puns more.
Well, Attila the pun, but okay.
I'm not going to go any further with that. We're going to give him a no-prize T-shirt as well. And you can find his latest Scuttlebutton puzzle and political junkie column at npr.org/junkie. So just when you thought the debates were finished, Mike Huckabee announced he is having a presidential forum on Saturday night on Fox News. There have been more than a dozen debates so far in this campaign with some memorable highs and lows. And we want to know something very specific. Was there one moment that made you change your mind on a candidate, other than Rick Perry saying, oops, that doesn't count, but something that really leapt out at you and touched you and moved you in one of these debates? Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Ken, I want to, talking about these debates, point out something that seems to happen a lot in the course of this kind of discourse, particularly in this season. Last Wednesday, CNN's John King asked Rick Santorum a very specific question. What should be the role of the United States in Syria? Santorum said this:
Syria is a puppet state of Iran.
And then he went on for more than a minute before he wound up here.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a president who isn't going to stop them. He isn't going to stop them from getting a nuclear weapon. We need a new president, or we are going to have a cataclysmic situation with a power that is the most prolific proliferator of terror in the world, that will be able to do so with impunity because they will have a nuclear weapon.
He was talking about Iran. The question was, what should be the role of the United States in Syria? I want to have join us now from member station WBUR in Boston, Alan Schroeder. He is the author of Presidential Debates, 40 Years of High-Risk TV. Alan, a very specific question about Syria was asked there. Should the U.S. intervene? It's important, it's relevant, it's difficult. And we heard an answer about the president's policy on Iran. What just happened there?
What just happened is the classic dodge that politicians do constantly in these debates. It's not quite as hostile as that Mitt Romney example you were talking about earlier, where he basically not only refuses to answer the question, but then tries to justify his refusal. But, you know, I think that one thing that happens is as you're watching debates, if you see candidates who are not being responsive or who are so obviously evasive, that that backfires because people are waiting for the answer. If they don't get it, then something's wrong.
You know, I question whether it does backfire, and I'll say why in a moment, but I want to point out that the very same question, John King then turned to Newt Gingrich and asked exactly the same question about the U.S. should it intervene in Syria. This was Gingrich's answer.
Well, look, the first thing I do across the board for the entire region is create a very dramatic American energy policy of opening up federal lands and opening up offshore drilling, replacing the EPA.
So that question about Syria became Newt Gingrich's talking point about oil drilling in the U.S. And what I'm wondering is, do they do it? You say that they don't get away with it. I wonder if they do because they do it again and again and again.
Well, in that little Newt Gingrich clip, the thing that strikes me is at least he was talking about the Middle East in his response as opposed to just using his entire response to complain about the format and the moderator and the questions. So for him, that was actually pretty responsive. But, yeah, politicians are almost, you know, that's their sort of reflex position is to try to bob and weave and evade the question. But I do think that anybody who's watching and paying the slightest bit of attention is going to notice that for whatever reason they weren't willing to grapple with the question.
So here's my question to you. How valuable are these debates as a way to understand what our candidates would do if in office about the specific things that are asked of them? Find out?
Well, they're probably not valuable for that particular thing that you just outlined there, because I think that debates are pretty bad predictors of what is going to happen. If you go all the way back to 1960 with John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon, there was not a single reference to Vietnam in any of those debates, and of course that became kind of the defining issue of the 1960s. Similarly, in 2000, when Bush and Gore debated, nobody was talking about terrorist attacks or threats from the Middle East or that sort of thing. What debates do tell you is a little bit about the character and the personalities of the people running for office. They're pretty good indicators of that sort of those sorts of personal characteristics, better indicators of that, I think, than policy positions.
Ken Rudin, do you agree with that the debates actually do tell us something about who the guys are?
I do, and I think that was part of the reason why a lot of people felt that for all, if you take a look at the debates in 2000 between Al Gore, Vice President Al Gore, and George W. Bush, people felt that George W. Bush was more likable, the kind of guy you wanted to have the beer with. And every time Al Gore would have that momentous sigh, you know, that, oh, what a dumb answer, but he would just sigh. Everybody said, oh, that says bad things about Gore. But it never addressed what Bush and Gore were talking about.
Does that bother you as somebody who follows this? Do you feel it's enough to kind of get the guy's style without really getting to his substance? Or do you think, even if they're not answering the questions or staying on topic, you do get their substance?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you do get the substance, you do get the personality, but as you know, Professor Schroeder would talk about, would say as well, that there were a lot of questions asked of the Republican candidates. What would they have done differently from President Obama on the stimulus package, on bailing out the auto companies, on doing X, Y, or Z? And there were not that many specifics at all, other than saying, well, I'll repeal Obamacare, or I won't, or we just have to get rid of Obama. And there were far less specifics than the question is demanded.
We want to ask you your views on these debates and whether there is a specific moment in a debate where something for you really happened, really clicked, and you were really able to make a decision. Our number is 800-989-8255, and I want to go now to Bend, Oregon, and we have Paul waiting online. Paul, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hey, hello there.
I'm sorry, Matthew. Matthew, my apologies.
I'm here.
Yeah.
From Bend, Oregon.
Yeah, you're on the air, and we'd like to hear your view on this.
So during the last debate, they asked Ron Paul why he differs or how he differs from the other three candidates, and his main thing was that he's a non-interventionist foreign policy. And I was just, you know, at that moment, I was like, you know, he really is the true conservative champion of the Constitution, and he kind of had me at that moment.
And you felt like the answer had substance?
It totally had substance. I feel like every answer he gives has substance.
Interestingly, on the question that I was using as an example about intervention in Syria, he answered very, very specifically, and he was the of the four candidates that night, he was the one who actually stayed on point on the question.
And I just felt like he always answered the question like that, and I was like, you know, at least he's being honest. You know, he's different than the other guys, but he's being honest with what he feels.
Alan Schroeder, what does that tell us about the debate as a forum to understand Ron Paul?
Well, I think, you know, Ron Paul is one of these people who, in this series of debates anyway, almost seems to have been, you know, sort of beamed in from another planet. He was so different from all the other candidates, not just stylistically, but in terms of the substance as well. But, you know, he's sort of the odd man out here, that he is not a traditional politician. He's much more willing to sort of say what's on his mind and not censor himself and edit himself in a debate situation. That's a pretty unusual tactic for any politician to take in a live debate, though.
When you talk of out of the mainstream or a kind of different kind of candidates, I always think of Herman Cain. And for the longest time, he was getting away with, in my view, he was getting away with that to me, simplistic 999 economic plan. And yet when he was in an interview not long later after one of the debates with the, I guess it was the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and they asked him about, you know, what about President Obama's position on Libya, you could see him sitting there for 20 minutes saying, Libya, Libya, and he had no idea what that was. So, you know, it's nice to have taglines. It's nice to have comfortable things you could fall back on. But you realize if the candidates don't really know what they're talking about, that comes through in debates as well.
Matthew, thank you.
I think that's right, Ken. And I think that Herman Cain is a classic example of one of the dangers of debates, which is that the format, you know, involves such short little parcels of time, especially when you've got the eight or nine people on the stage, that you can get away with sound bites and you can get away with real cursory, superficial answers simply by virtue of the clock. There's just not time for anybody to have an opportunity to go very deep.
Matthew, thank you for your call, and we're going to go now to Tom in Tampa, Florida. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Yes, my comment, I believe, came from the first debate from Rick Perry when he bragged that in Texas they'd executed, I believe, 256 people, and the just got a roaring applause from the crowd there, and I was thinking, you know, this is like an alien people for me. I can't believe that they're doing this, and I haven't heard anyone come down on the Republican Party for this, any sort of backlash at all.
So did you feel that you saw the light in that moment in some way, that you saw a truth that emerged from the debate?
Well, I didn't get a very good impression of Rick Perry from that, but the Republican Party didn't seem to be my party at that particular point in time. I said, you know, this is not what I believe in. I would say that death penalty is something to be carried out with, you know, reluctance and regret and so on, not something to be bragged about.
All right, Tom, thank you for your comment. We're going to go now to Joshua in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yes. The moment for me was when Newt, which I was leaning towards Newt prior to this moment, where he stood up and said that he would be the president to get black people off of welfare, mm-hmm. which... The statement in and of itself floored me for many reasons, one of which is anyone who does just a little research knows that black people aren't the majority of the people on welfare. But that, to me, just showed his, he has a very mean-spirited side to him, which first became apparent at that particular moment. So I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Ken Rudin.
Well, you know, there's a good point to be made here, and you wonder when you hear Mitt Romney saying so many of the things he says during the debate, are these the things he really, really believes, or has the Republican Party moved in such a way that for him to break away from that mold, he gets pilloried by the Tea Party conservatives? So you wonder if who's leading the party, whether it's the candidates leading the party, or as the case, with, for example, with the executions, when the audience cheered that, you just wonder if the Republican Party has moved to such a point where, for the candidates, they don't follow along at their peril.
Alan Schroeder, was there ever in the televised era some imagined golden age of debate when it was more substantive? I mean, you mentioned earlier that the first televised debate, Nixon-Kennedy, they never mentioned Vietnam. Was it ever better?
Yeah, I think the Kennedy-Nixon debates were quite substantive by today's standards. And I think that every cycle that goes along, maybe that level of substantiveness diminishes a little bit. Some of it is just that there are more debates, but there's also the debates now are much more packaged than they've ever been. I'm thinking this primary season of one that CNN did where they introduced each candidate with a little tagline, you know, Newt Gingrich, the big thinker, Michelle Bachmann, the firebrand, John Huntsman, the diplomat, et cetera, with the music and the images and all of this stuff. And so the debate...
It was world wrestling, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was world wrestling. It was a reality show. And so I think what we're seeing is that that you know, everything is getting more superficial, the media, politics, everything, and so the debates are kind of reflected in that trend.
But in fairness, remember when you're talking about Kennedy Nixon and Ford Carter, that was one-on-one, two general election candidates. You didn't have eight people on the stage trying to get 30 seconds of clever soundbite, so it was a different format completely.
That's right. And there is a big distinction to draw between the general election debates and the primary debates. One of the frustrations I'm having is that now that we're down to four people, you know, this is where we should be having more debates, not fewer, because people are actually getting the time on the stage to say things.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Alan Schroeder, are candidates, would they be crazy actually to address the questions and take them on specifically as opposed to using them as opportunities to launch into prepared speeches?
I think it would be so refreshing for the audience to have a candidate who was responsive and who was candid and who didn't duck the questions or fight with the moderator or argue about the format or any of the things that distract. And why somebody doesn't do that, I'm not sure. But you know, these candidates come in so heavily programmed. There's a lot of, you know, ego involved. There's a lot of jockeying for time. And it is, I will say, it is very difficult with eight or nine people on the stage. If you were the candidate, it's very difficult to sort of have any control over your performance and how you deliver it, just given the logistics and the timing.
Ken Rudin, am I wrong, but does it also seem as though the audiences for the debates are programmed?
Well, I've never seen this before. I think I saw a little bit of it in 2008, but they seem to be hooting. I mean, I saw this actually with Gore and Bradley in 2000. There was a Democratic debate at the Apollo Theater, and the audience was really yelling out things. But that's a pretty new phenomenon. I mean, I don't remember people screaming out, and Kennedy Nixon. Of course, it wasn't before a live audience. It was on television just with cameras. But it becomes, you know, gladiator battle. It becomes, you know, the Coliseum when every mistake or good thing, you know, is responded with a hoot or a holler, and that's not the way you get any kind of dialogue working.
Let's bring in Doug from San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Doug. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Something that stood out for me in the last debate was when the moderator asked each candidate to describe themselves using one word only. And I think all the candidates lost a great opportunity to really emphasize how conservative they were. Romney has been calling himself severely conservative, but none of them used that word to describe themselves. In fact, Rick Santorum used the word courage, yet earlier in the debate, he admitted that he voted on something that he really didn't agree with, which showed me he had no courage.
Hmm. And I want to ask you, Doug, about Alan Schroeder's point for you as let's say a consumer of this product, which seems to be what some of it is at least. Do you judge the candidates badly for not answering the specific questions? Do you notice it, and does it get to you?
Absolutely. I'm a student of debates actually, and it really irritates me and a lot of other people when the candidates are asked a very specific question, yet they give very broad answers and usually not even related to the question itself. So, yes, it doesn't provide a service or it doesn't lead to inform the constituency to make a better decision. So I think the candidates do all a disservice by avoiding the question altogether.
All right, Ken Rudin.
And yet, early in the debate series, when Newt Gingrich said, "I'm not going to fall into one of those gotcha questions," that was the beginning of Newt Gingrich's rise in the Republican ranks, when he had the guts, I guess, or temerity, to take on the moderator by saying, "I won't answer your question. I won't answer your gotcha questions. It's a typical media question," and he zoomed up in the polls because of that response.
Finally, I just want to bring in an emailer who says, "Why don't moderators take on these evasive politicians? Is it for ratings that they foster talking points and don't demand with their own conversational presence that the figureheads on the stage are to be held as the same standards as someone you would debate at the dinner table?" Good finish. I want to thank you very much, Ken Rudin and Alan Schroeder, for joining us on this edition of Political Junkie. Coming up, Sandra Singh Lowe gives voice to a frustration felt by many adult children who are now caring for their elderly parents. Sometimes, she admits, she just wishes he would die. Have you lived this internal conflict? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.